But before we go into the main message, the sermon for today, I do have some news analysis items which I think would be worthwhile bringing to everybody's attention. There's quite a bit going on in the news, one way or another. In today's paper, right on the headlines of today's paper, was bird flu outbreak leads to fears of a pandemic. This is also another one. This is from the Mail of Wednesday this week. It says bird flu pandemic could kill 750,000 Britons. So it's certainly, they are almost bracing themselves for this. But on the front of the Telegraph, it says here, avian influenza is still spreading despite countermeasures, and the possibility of a global epidemic that could kill millions is said to be more likely than not. So in other words, it's more than just 50% chance, it's more likely than not. More than 50 people have died from the H5N1 virus in Southeast Asia, most of them in Vietnam, where tens of thousands raise poultry in small backyard farms. So the World Health Organization computer models suggest that a pandemic of H5N1 would kill between 7.5 million within 12 months in a best-case scenario. So it's quite a phenomenal number there, based on the mild pandemic of the 1968. But if this is similar to the 1918 pandemic, the models estimate a much higher total. The fact that it's been around for a year and we haven't seen a pandemic is no reason to be complacent, he said. I'm more concerned than I even was a year ago. So it certainly is something that we need to be watching. And in that light, just turn over with me, if you would, to Revelation 6. Revelation 6. It's worthwhile reading it again and just reminding ourselves why we look at news items such as this and why we hold them to be significant. Because here in Revelation, and it's mirrored over in Matthew 24, we see the different, as it describes it in Matthew 24, they are birth pains, and it mirrors these four horsemen, and the four horsemen being the white horse of religious confusion in verse 2, and then the red horse of war in verse 4, and then you're looking at a black horse of famine in verse 5, and we see that certainly in Africa from time to time. And then finally, you've also got this pale horse in verse 8, and it says, I looked and behold a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was death, and hell followed him. And it mirrors the pandemics, it mirrors the pestilences that are mentioned over in Matthew 24. And it says, power was given unto them. It says unto them here, whether in fact that's referring to all four, or if you notice in my margin it says unto him, it almost looks as if it's unto the one with the pandemics. It says, and power is given unto him or them over the fourth part, so a quarter of the earth, to kill with sword and hunger and death and with the beasts of the earth. So there are certain things which are mentioned here which certainly indicate that a large loss of life will take place. And this is why when we're looking at something like this bird flu, it is just one of the areas that we do need to be aware of. You also look at the lack of fitness that there is within society, and of course that lays people open to the problems that of this kind of thing. At the same time as we see items like this, we also see events that are forecast a little bit later than the birth pains, if you like, that are leading into the tribulation. As you know, the Pope has died. And there's been several articles around over the past couple of weeks regarding the Pope and Catholicism. And there's one here, conquering apathy is the biggest challenge, and it gives an actual map. And it shows the net gains and the net losses in Catholicism. You know, you can come up and have a look at it if you want. You can't see it from here. Certainly not in America, you can't, anyway. But it says here, it says the result, it says the next Pope will face a church and a world much challenged from that which, or much changed, sorry, from that which John Paul II inherited in 1978. It goes on, the little known Polish cardinal was an inspired choice for an era when the church's main rival was a competing ideological system, which was communism. So here was a Pope that had been actually grown up in communist countries. But it says he proved considerably less effective against the more insidious and ultimately more dangerous threat to the faith in the West, the moral relativism, materialism, agnosticism, and apathy. And that does seem to be a problem. And if you notice where these net gains are, I mean, Nigeria is plus 6.3%, Micronesia, well, I presume this is all of Indonesia and that area around there, is plus 37.1%. And they were already fairly well Catholic before. But you come into Austria and it's minus 17%. France is minus 11.6%. Puerto Rico is minus 24.4%. And of course, I mean, comparing it with, as far as the Western world is concerned, as far as the Britain and America, we don't tend to be a Catholic country anyway. Or do we? Well, as we go on to see, actually read certain items, there are indications that that is moving. One thing we need to be aware of, and again, just keep in the back of our mind, is that when you're looking at Pope John Paul's funeral, there was all call for him to be sanctified. We should be sanctified already, but there was call for him to be made a saint. And one of the things that they require of saints is that miracles are associated with him. Now, miracles apparently have already been associated with him. It's got an article here. It says, Pope miraculously cured Jewish millionaire. Pope John Paul was responsible for the miraculous cure of a Jewish-American millionaire who was dying from a brain tumor, it was claimed yesterday, as the campaign to set the late Pope on the fast track to sainthood got underway. And it was going. It basically describes this incident where this individual came and asked if he would actually be able to meet the Pope, and he was, and he was able to pray with him, and actually he took Holy Communion, in quotes, you know, with the Pope, even though he's a Jew. And he got back to America and found that his brain tumour had disappeared. Now this obviously is being hyped up at the moment. Now that's not going to go ahead and make the Pope a saint in Catholic eyes, because what they're looking for is they're looking for miracles that are associated with the Pope after his death. The reason for that is they think the Pope then goes to heaven, has intercession with God, and causes miracles. That proves he's a saint. So that's the kind of logic behind it. But that is very interesting when you look at what in fact is forecast, what in fact is prophesied, as far as the miracles being done. And you know, it is something that we need to be aware of, and we need to be watching in that regard. Another one here from the 4th of this month, it says, world has come to expect a charismatic religious leader for a 21st century church. Now that again fits in with what we see in prophecy. It says the next pope must address this problem by, it says, what's the problem? It says Catholics in the West are only too aware of the dismal standards of liturgy, preaching and music that prevail in most parishes. It says the next pope must address this problem by reintroducing the beauty and mystery that used to be synonymous with Catholicism. Technically that's the responsibility of diocesan bishops, but here again is another difficult aspect of John Paul's legacy. His conservatism has been exaggerated while insisting that bishops should be orthodox. He promoted many left-wing mediocrities, not least in England and Wales. And it goes on and says, for that reason, Roman Catholics should hope that once again the Holy Spirit springs a surprise on his church. This again is coming from the Telegraph. It's interesting that terminology such as that is being used within the media. Just be aware, again, let's just read one of the scriptures I was noticing today. Over in Revelation 13, and just remind ourselves a little bit about Revelation 13 and what it actually says here. I'm going to have to give a sermon on prophecy. It's not the kind of subject that needs to be dealt with just before Passover, but I think I need to in the not too distant future. But here in Revelation 13, it's talking about the beast. It's an inset chapter, Revelation 13, dealing with the political system, the system of Satan, basically. And it talks about the beast coming out of the sea, and how he was basically tied up with the beast that you find in Daniel, and having the strength of those beasts, and it's the Roman Empire you're looking at. And in verse 3 it says, I saw one of his heads wounded to death, and a deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And it goes into the Holy Roman Empire then, in that particular place within Revelation. And it talks about the great mouth speaking great things and blasphemies and power to make war with the saints, verse 7. And it goes on and it says, he that leads in captivity, verse 10, shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. In other words, we need to hang on to the fact that God is not mocked by this particular system. But I want you to notice what it says in verse 11. It says, "And I behold another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon." Now here again, you're looking at this same beast, this beast, this Holy Roman Empire. It's the papacy, it's the church, in that sense, the church that actually rides the Holy Roman Empire. "And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and those that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed." So it's actually riding that particular beast. "And he does great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceives them that dwell on the earth by the means of the miracles that he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast which had the wound and sword and did live." In other words, he is promoting the Holy Roman Empire right at the very end time. And this is what we're looking at. Certainly it's something that happened as far as the previous pope was concerned. It is something we need to be aware of for the pope that is about to appear on the scene. "And he had the power to give life to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should speak and cause as many that shouldn't worship the image of the beast should be killed." So he gives a certain power to this Holy Roman Empire that will be arising in Europe, causing all, both small, great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And we understand, you know, the law, in fact, the only one commandment is linked to this, and that's the commandment of the Sabbath. "That no man may buy or sell except that he had this mark on name of the beast or the number of his name. And here's wisdom. Let him that has understanding count the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, actually counting that, Mr. Ian Henderson gave a sermon on that not too long ago. Certainly go back into the archives and dig it out if you want to listen to it. But the way you count the 666 is by looking at the Hebrew and the Greek. But it is interesting that this particular pope that is about to arise, if you take the, you know, this is an interesting fact that has kind of done the rounds on the internet. You know how you got Pope John Paul II now, and you got John Paul I that died rather swiftly. If you take all the numbers, in other words, the first, the second, Pope Pius the whatever, seventh or whatever he might have been, and all of the numbers of all the popes that are known, and if this one has Pope, I don't know, Bartholomew the first or whatever he might be, or Pope some other name which would be the first, if this says he's the first, that would be exactly 666 from start to finish. Now, it may be absolutely nothing to do with that, but it is an interesting aspect that you need to keep an eye on. It says here in the 14th, that was Thursday, it says, "A cardinal split over the choice for the new pope. It says, a battle for the soul of Catholicism was unfolding in the Vatican yesterday as progressive cardinals struggled to head off a conservative victory in next week's conclave. Two main groups have emerged from within the 115 cardinals eligible to vote for the successor of John Paul II when they met under lock and key in the Sistine Chapel on Monday. The first group, referred to by some cardinals as the Integristi, the Integrates or Conservatives, is falling in behind Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. It says, sources say that there's little doubt that a Bavarian-born cardinal," and again, it does seem to be there's a German or an Assyrian emphasis, therefore, coming into the picture, "has the early momentum and has garnered the support of more than a third of the electorate. But the sources add that his successor is far from succession is far from assured, and that the other group, dubbed the Reformers, is attempting a fight back, and there's still a long way to go." It says, "The Reformers have yet to concede defeat," say insiders. "They believe that they also command a third of the votes, but their main weakness is they've got no credible candidate. They have, however, rallied around Cardinal Carlo Maria Martini, a former Archbishop of Milan, who has been in retirement in Jerusalem for years." So his centre, and it has been for years, has been Jerusalem. Which again, make careful note. "Cardinal Martini made a powerful speech at the Cardinals on Monday. At 78, he's almost the same age as Cardinal Ratzinger, but he has health problems. He has a weak heart and might also be in the early stages of Parkinson's disease, which means that he is not such, he is an unlikely pope. But, you know, again, remember Pope John Paul I, he reigned for a very, very short time indeed, and it could be that that is what's going to happen. You know, you go back to Malarkey's prophecies, and I don't recommend that people go ahead and put too much credence on Malarkey's prophecies, but they reckon that this pope is the last one. The next one is called Peter the Roman. It differs in a way in which it was described. It's giving a specific name to the next one, whereas the popes, and he was supposed to help the church through difficult times, but they reckon the last pope is this next one. Now, as I say, you're dealing with lying spirits, so you don't go ahead and put too much credence on it. But these lying spirits, they've got to have some kind of credence. So if you have credence from these lying spirits and you have the miracles then follow, then you hey, look out, we're on a home run. So as we prepare for Passover this year, we need to be preparing for Passover this year. We don't know what next year may bring. Another one from today, it says, God's Rottweiler leads the short lifts as a conclave gathers to elect the Pope. I don't think you see that in a Catholic country, but nevertheless, it says here, it says about Cardinal Ratzinger is a front runner as the Cardinal's choice to succeed Pope John Paul. So, a fair amount is going on there with the election of the Pope, and we need to watch it with interest. Certainly, be aware that you're Satan, the very God of this world, and his church. Now, one thing I did want to comment a little bit about the news, and in the elections that are being held in France. Now, you've probably seen on the news a fair amount about the elections in France and how the no vote is gaining ascendancy to a large degree. Now, we look in Britain and we see the no vote over here, and the no vote is anti-Europe. And it's trying to make sure that the no vote, like UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, is trying to pull us out of Europe. And so the no vote is to say, hey, we're not going into this federalist state that's in this constitution. And yet Mr. Blair and the other major parties are saying, well, no, it's not a federalist state. It is, in fact, we've gone ahead and we've watered it down. We've gone ahead and put various clauses in, and we've got something which is acceptable to the British people. Now, the interesting thing is that right now is this campaign where President Chirac in France is trying to salvage the EU constitution, that we also will be, I say we, not we, but they, will be also voting for over here in the UK. And here in Thursday's, it says, is Chirac too late to save the EU constitution? What I want you to notice is that it says that the date was fixed for May the 29th, and it says 5 weeks ago, a few days after Mr. Chirac brought forward the referendum from late summer, an opinion poll found 6 voters in 10 planning to vote yes, which is why he brought it forward, obviously. It says, but the mood has turned sharply against the centre-right government, as an assortment of domestic grievances has brought workers, professionals and students out on strike and on the streets, and after 11 successive polls in its favour, the latest indicating a 53% majority to reject the constitution, the no camp is scenting victory. So it looks as if the no camp in France is going to, you know, could well win. And we look at that and hear from our perspective here in Britain, and we think, oh well, that's going to really scupper it, because obviously therefore we won't have a constitution, and we think therefore Europe is taking a step backwards. In fact, that's not what is happening. It says Mr. Jeannereau has heard that some British Eurosceptics are encouraged by the news of the rising no vote. Let's hold this line, actually read it. By the rising no vote in France, but he offered a warning to the British no sympathisers yearning for a French upset. A French no would be bad news for British Conservatives and for those who do not want a federal Europe, a harmonised Europe, he said. A French no would be a pro-European no. In other words, the French no camp are not like the British no camp. The French no camp are even further into federalism. They look at the constitution and they say, hey, that doesn't go far enough. So if the French vote no, it's not against the federalism. It's against the lack of federalism in the current constitution. It's pushing it further. A French no would be a pro-European no from people who want more political powers for Europe. And another speaker at the rally, Gérard Pilochet, went further, calling for a French no to forestall the prospect of a British no and ensure that the French voices dominate the debate that would follow the collapse of the draft constitution. If it's a British no, we'll all be talking about sovereignty and finances, Mr. Pilochet said. If it's a French no, we'll be talking about building a social Europe, and the merits of a social Europe are barely debated. Now, we need to understand that when we're looking at, let me give you some of the ideas that they've got. It says more power for the European Parliament, confrontation with the United States, more power for trade unions and workers and curbs on the powers of employers, a regulated market, legal protection for the high wage job of the old Europe, including state subsidies, now state subsidies for alien companies, formal obstacles to completion from the low wage economies, and ideally a European minimum wage. So it's a very social Europe that they're wanting. We need to understand that when you're looking at the political sides, in other words, the wings of, you know, the right wing or the left wing in politics, you're not looking at something which is opposing sides, as they have in the British Parliament, say. What you're actually looking at is the Greek model, and this was like an amphitheatre, and the speaker was in the one side of the amphitheatre, and the wings went right the way around, right up to the speaker. So if you've got a very left wing government, super left wing government, it is very, very, very near a super right wing government as well, because you just go across the speaker and you're there. Because the super right wing, where controlled totally by the state, and super left wing, where you're looking at certain, you're looking at state control, state industry being supported and all this kind of thing, state industry being supported and all this kind of thing on the right wing as well, they're very, very similar. They're just on the either sides of this this almost like an amphitheatre, which is the way it was designed on. It goes on about the EU diehards ganging up on Britain, and at the same time we've got anti-Semitic violence on the rise in France. This was from the 22nd of this month. We've got another article on the 1st of this month which says ailing Germany is sliding down the economic league. They say, well, okay, but what's significant about that? Well, that's what happened before the rise of Hitler. We've got another one here. This is from Friday. This is yesterday. So Schroeder is trying to kickstart Germany, but critics say he's papering over the cracks. So they're trying to do something because Germany is struggling at the moment. And at the same time as you see that, you've got another one of the 25th of last month. It says Hitler books show a new obsession that is gripping Germans. So they're swinging to the right. They're moving in that direction. It says here, while a few would argue that the fascination amounts to admiration of the Nazis, historians say that the frequency with which Hitler's image appears on the media is harmful. This is in Germany now. Television, cinemas and illustrated magazines are bringing the form of brown uniformed soldiers or SS officers into our living rooms with an intensity that's never been known before. The heroes of the crimes against humanity are laughing in our faces, wrote Jensen. A poll published yesterday shows huge sympathy for right-wing extremists among Germans from the capital and the surrounding region. National socialism had its positive size, thought the 15% of Berliners and 20% of people living in the neighbouring state of Brandenburg. At the same time, 12% of Berliners and 24% of Brandenburgers said they wanted a Führer who would rule with a firm hand. So in other words, they see what is happening within the society. And remember, Hitler was voted to power. So we're looking, again, we're looking at the need for a strong man. I always remember my mother talking about, she was a governess at a university professor's house when she was in her late teens. And at the same house was the cook, who was German, and this was just before the Second World War. And she got the other side of the view of Hitler. On the British side, obviously, and on the American side, Hitler is painted as some kind of absolute demon who somehow got into power and nobody quite knows how. No, he's not. He's somebody who got into power in enormous popularity. He had enormous popularity to sort things out. And so we do need to be aware and do need to be watching for somebody like that arising who is of the Assyrian extraction. Now, at the same time as this is going on, we and all the business with Catholicism and so on, we've got other articles that are appearing. One appeared on the 7th of this month that said British attitudes to Roman Catholics have mellowed. And it says here, it says the Pope transformed British attitudes towards Roman Catholicism. A shift reflected in the presence of the future monarch, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Prime Minister at his funeral, Cormac Murphy O'Connor said yesterday. And it says, Cardinal said in Rome yesterday that he would be seeing Dr. Rowan Williams tomorrow night for service at the English College before the funeral on Friday. It is quite remarkable that it is the first time in history that we will have an Archbishop of Canterbury, the heir to the throne, the Prince of Wales, and the Prime Minister Tony Blair attending a funeral of the Pope together. The English Church is now more accepted and recognised. The Pope has left a legacy in the world, and on it goes. So that is certainly a shift in emphasis. I think this was read actually last week about the revealed Tony Blair's Catholic secret, that he celebrated a Catholic Mass with the Pope when he was down there. This tolerance goes to the words Muslims, Britain's Muslims, praised by Brown there. Another thing that is interesting, and that is that it says Michael Howard, the Tory leader, is backing the abolition of the centuries-old ban on the monarch becoming or marrying a Roman Catholic. He described the present position as an anachronism and promised to consider reforms if he became Prime Minister. So here is somebody who is a Jew who is wanting to get rid of the Catholic laws within this country that have existed for centuries and change the very monarchy itself. It goes even the Daily Telegram graph, it says, imagine a religion that was once considered so abhorrent that a country's head of state is still forbidden not only to belong to it but also to marry anyone who does. Moreover, even his or her distant relations become ineligible to become head of state if they marry someone who adheres to this faith. And the country is modern Britain. The religion in question is not a sect of hooded Satanists. The world's largest Christian church, the legislation barring anyone who professed the popish religion or marry a papist is the Act of Settlement of 1701. And that remains on the statute book. So another indication that a move is afoot is how a Catholic, well, this is coming from, The Guardian. And it says here, it says, the Catholic Church condemns a Tory conspiracy theorist, a Tory candidate who believes that the EU is a Catholic plot to impose Vatican sovereignty over Britain was today accused by the Catholic Church of preaching a conspiracy theory traditionally associated with the far right. And so it goes on, and this is talking about Adrian Hilton. And it says, today, a fellow Conservative candidate deselected by Tory central office, Adrian Hilton, called London officials little dictators for attempting to squash locally approved candidates. So, Adrian Hilton, who wrote a book, it says, Mr. Hilton sacked as prospective parliamentary candidate for Slough after Guardian Unlimited revealed that he was the author of articles calling the EU a Catholic conspiracy against Britain, says ordinary Conservative members were being treated with contempt by central office, and he warned he would pursue the matter in law because of natural justice and so on. So there is a move afoot to try and squash any criticism of the Europe that is arising. So you see all of this fitting together, you see all these isolated little snippets of news, and yet a picture, a pattern emerges. And it's that pattern that we want to keep our eyes on very, very clearly, and we need to do particularly as we move forward in this year. But you know, as I say, as we now prepare for the Passover, our minds should be going on beyond that to our position in the very kingdom of God.